If there's anything that opens us to the touch of God, it would have to be our capacity to love. If there's anything that gets us, opens us up, that gets us out of ourselves, it's the act of loving someone else. And once we do this, once we get called out of ourselves, once we break that fixation that wants to remain preoccupied with ourselves and our own welfare, once we get out of ourselves, we are open to God. The first boy that I ever taught that came into my university classroom with shoulder-length hair really bothered me. And it turned out that he was also the resident atheist in my theology of faith class. And he wasn't a good, hard-nosed atheist with whom you could have a good fight. He was a whimpering atheist. He wasn't sure. And he really bothered me, I must say. And at the end of the course, he came up with his final exam, and he was about to put it down. And he said, Father, do you think I'll ever find God? And immediately there occurred to me to try a little shock therapy on him, and I said, no, you won't. Thank you, and I took his exam. And I waited till he got near the door, and I said, Tom, he turned around, huh? And I said, I feel quite sure you'll never find God, but I'm absolutely sure that he will find you. And he said, And he walked out. And I thought my line was a real zinger, you know. I thought I was, but he seemed to miss it. It seemed to go right over his head, and I thought, oh, you creep. I was being so smart, and you were being so dumb. Then I heard that he went over to our Rome Center and came back and was graduated. I was glad to hear that. I always thought about that kid, that if you ever really got an idea, it would die of lonesomeness. And then I heard he was sick, that he was dying. And 6 months ago, he walked into my office, and he was proverbial skin and bones. And a lot of that long hair, perhaps because of the use of cobalt treatments, had fallen out. And he said, hello, Father. I said, Tom, I hear you're sick. He said, I got cancer in both lungs. That's pretty sick, isn't it? I said, yeah, Tom, that's real sick. Can you sit down and talk about it? And he said, sure. I said, can I ask anything I want to? He said, sure, go ahead. I said, Tom, what are you, 23 now? He said, yeah, 23. Tom, what's it like to be 23 and dying? And this kid, who I was sure was my prime lightweight atheist in the theology of faith course, looked at me and said, well, it could be worse. If I was 50 years old and thought that there was nothing important in life except booze and broads and money, if I were 50 years old and I didn't have anything to love or live for, that would be worse than dying at 23. And I was just really amazed at what had happened to this kid since I had him in class. And we talked about death, and I admitted to him that I think, even though my job as a priest supposedly is to get people ready to die, to get them ready to live and to get them ready to die, I think I am afraid of death. I think when the death sentence is pronounced on me by some doctor, I think I will be very afraid. And I admitted this to the boy, and I said, are you afraid? And he said, no, not now. But I want to tell you why. He said, do you remember the last day of our class together? And I came up with my final exam, and I asked you if you thought I would ever find God. And he remembered that. I thought he missed the whole point. And he said, and you said a very firm no. No, you won't. But then you waited till I nearly got out of the classroom, and you said, but Tom, he'll find you. He'll get you. And I thought about that. And I was always curious about God. I wasn't able to believe in him, but I was always curious about him. And then I got a lump in my groin. And the doctors took it out, and they said it was malignant. They said, you have cancer. But we think we got it all. Doctors always tell you that. They think they have it all. And then they tell you, after you're ready for it, that your lymphatic system, however, was affected by the cancer. Which means there's a good chance that the cancer has spread and will grow somewhere else. And then you get a lump on your chest. And then the doctors tell you, you have cancer in both lungs. We will start chemotherapy now. That's the only reason I'm alive, you know, is just these anti-cancer drugs, chemotherapy. When they first took the lump out of the groin and they said, you have cancer, the idle question of whether there was a God, whether this God was my father, suddenly became an urgent and insistent question. And I beat my fists against the doors of heaven and I said, God, if you're in there, come out. God, I'm dying. I'm gonna die. Come out and speak to me. And I have to tell you this, Father, I got no response. God did not speak to me. And then I gave up. I decided that I really didn't care whether there was a God or not. I didn't even care whether there was an afterlife or not. He said, you know how when you try something really hard for a long time and you get nowhere? And you give up. You've had enough. That's the way I felt. And then something else that you said in class came back to me. You said, what a pity it would be if you died without having really loved. What a pity it would be if you died and you never really told the people you had loved that you loved them. And that seemed very important to me when I gave up trying to make connections with God. And so I went to my father. My father and I have never really talked. And I said, Dad, I know I gave you a hard time at times. I disobeyed you. I know I made you worry. But Dad, you know what? I loved you. I really loved you. And he said, my father did something I've never seen my father do. He turned soft and he started to cry. And he did something I would have never believed my father was capable of. He put his arms around me. He hugged me. And when I found my father hugging me and crying, I started to cry myself. It was like a glacier of ice that was melting. My father loved me, and I loved him. And we sat up half the night talking, another thing we had never really done. And then I went to my little brother, and I said to him, you know, kid, I pushed you around, and I embarrassed you, and I wouldn't take you with me when I went out. But before I die, I want to tell you something. I loved you too. My little brother cried, and he told me that he loved me. And while I was in the process of doing this, while I was in the process of opening my heart to those who had been close to me, suddenly the God that I had been demanding out of his heaven came to me. He was there. He was there. And you'd be surprised now at the atheist from your Theology of Faith course, because God is very real to me. God has passed from being a person about whom people talked to someone that I could know, someone that I could talk to, and I'm praying to God now and everything. And I sat there looking at Tommy, and I kept thinking, what you're telling me is very important. As long as you say to God, come on, God, come on, come on, God, jump through my hoop, come to me, I've only got a few months to live, God does not come. Apparently, we can't tell God when to come and when not to come. But he said, by this shall men know that you are my disciples, you love one another. And in the act of going out to another person, in the act of loving, he will be there. Tom, I think you're telling me something. I think you're telling me that when people begin to love, really love, and really express their love for each other, that they will find God. You know, I used to wonder where all the happy marriages were, because most of the marriages that I saw were not too happy. The marriage that my own parents had was not too happy. I see young people today wanting to live together without signing any names on paper, without being committed to anything. And I wonder if it's because they have not seen many happy marriages. They don't want to commit themselves to the kind of marriages that they saw. I don't know about that, but at any rate. Then I saw the movement called the Marriage Encounter. Now, I don't know if you know about it, and I'm not going to stop and give a commercial, but it's a movement where a couple goes away, a married couple goes away for a weekend, and they learn to communicate. Now, the one thing I noticed as these people really learned to open up to each other in love, in the Marriage Encounter, was the immediate entrance of God into both of their lives. That they were not only very happy marriages, which I had been looking for, hoping and wanting to believe that marriage could be a progressively more beautiful thing, but God was coming more and more into the minds and hearts of both. And I thought that my observation of the Marriage Encounter people and of my young friend, they're all telling me the same thing. The place to find God is in love. St. John says, God is love, and whoever abides in love abides in God. And I want to preach this loud and clear to the whole world, that God is love, and whoever abides in love can't be far from God, because God is love, and God is the source of all love. And so I asked myself, why can't people love? Why don't they love more? What's the matter? And I recall a real transforming incident from my own life that answered that question for me. And I'd like to share that experience with you, because if it means to you what it has meant to me, it will be very important to you. Many years ago, I was teaching in a seminary, and I was giving retreats. I have a lot of mileage on my mouth and preaching, and this lady called up who had made a retreat, and she said, "Father, we have an 18-year-old daughter who's an alcoholic. Would you talk to her?" And I agreed that I would. And you know, when parents ask you to talk to one of their children, what they mean. You know, they really want you to solve their problem. You talk to this girl. You give her a good lecturing. So the parents came down with the girl to the seminary on a Sunday afternoon, and the father stormed in and he said, "I'm General Bull Moose." That was not his name, but that was his manner. And he said, "And this is the kid." And standing there with her hand on her hip, with a very cynical look on her face, was the kid. The 18-year-old alcoholic. And the father said, "You want to hear her latest?" We're standing right in the door of the seminary, and all kinds of people are going in and out. And I said, "No, I don't think so. Not right here, anyway." He said, "What do you want me to do?" And I said, "We have some very beautiful gardens out there. Why don't you and your wife take a walk?" So he said to his wife, "Come on, Gert, let's go." And so I asked the girl if she wanted to sit down, and I figured that my Italian-Irish charm would melt her in no time. And after about 10 minutes, she said, "Want to hear my latest?" And I said, "Yeah, I really do. You know, after what your father said, I bet it's really juicy, huh?" She said, "I chugged a bottle of vodka." And I said, you chugged a whole fifth of vodka?" "Yeah." I said, "What happened?" She says, "How am I supposed to know? I went out." I said, "You must have gone out." She says, "I went out so bad they had to get a doctor to revive me." I said, "I imagine. What else do you do for kicks?" And she told me about her boyfriend who was a drunken bum who had never held a job. He was proud of that. He made all his money hustling in a pool hall. He was after his dishonorable discharge from the armed services. She never went to church. She drank a lot. She was in pretty bad shape. And she said, "But my father has always been accusing me of everything. You know, I never really did these things until I would come home and he would start grilling me and he'd accuse me. Did you do this? Did you do that?" And finally it occurred to me, well, if you're going to think that, I'm going to do it. If you got the name, you might as well have the game. So I started doing all the things that he was worried about. Well, I asked her, "Does your father ever tell you he loves you?" "My father? My father tell anybody he loves them?" "No, no, my father never says anything like that." "Did he ever show you anyway, you know? Did he ever hug you?" "No. No." So when the man and his wife, Bull Moose and his wife, came in from their walk, I asked the girl if I could talk to them alone. And I said to the father, "I think I know why your daughter's drinking." And he said, "Good. Why is she drinking?" I said, "It's you." He said, "Me? I don't even drink." I said, "Maybe you'd better if you did. You know? Because I think you drove that kid to drink." And he said, "I don't drive anybody to drink. I'm against drink." I said, "Do you ever show your children affection?" He said, "I'm not the gushy type." I said, "Oh, come on. Who asked you whether you were the gushy type? I asked you, do you ever show your children affection?" He said, "Look, I'm a moral man. I believe a father's job is to set an example for his children. and I set a good example. And I said, bully for you, baby. We'll give you a medal that you can wear in the next dress parade. But there is another very important question. Does that kid know you love her? Has she ever thought that? You know, if you build a pedestal for a kid, he'll climb up on it. But if you dig a hole for a kid, he'll fall into it. So the man said to his wife, let's get out of here. He's lecturing me, not her. And they left. But before the girl left, she said, could I come back and see you? Could I come back, say, like once a week? And in this particular seminary where I was teaching at the time, there was nothing doing every minute. So I said, sure, sure, you can come. So once a week she would come. And every time she came, I liked her less. And one day she walked in and she's, oh, damn. And I said, oh, pray tell, honey, who hurts you now? She's my mother and father. I'm going to get even with them. I said, what did they do? She said, they wouldn't let me go to this nightclub, which was a horrible dive in that part of the country. Worse than that part of the country. It was terrible. She said, my parents wouldn't let me go. And I said, why wouldn't they let you go? She says, I don't know. Well, maybe we can think of a reason. I told you, I don't know. And I said, that's why I said maybe we could think of a reason. Maybe they love you. She says, oh, shoot. They don't love me. I said, maybe they do. If you were my daughter, I wouldn't want you to go to that dive. I wouldn't want you to get hurt. And she said, oh, get off it. And I said, listen, dear, you know what you need? You need a Copernican revolution. You need to find out that the whole world doesn't really revolve around you. That you were meant to revolve around the world. That everybody isn't here, you know, to make sure that you're going to have a good time. Do you know, honey, that there are people in the world that are starving to death? Do you know that there are people that are having their guts ripped out of them inch by inch, death by cancer? There are people right now who are twisting in pain and their bodies are covered with sweat because they're in awful agony. Do you know that? Do you know they sweep up bodies every morning on the streets of the poor countries, of the victims of starvation? And she put her hand on her hip and she said, oh, come on, name two that you know. And I sort of saw red. And I said, I hope you learn to love somebody before you die. And she said, I'm getting out of here. And she grabbed her things and started walking out. And I walked with her to the door. And as she was leaving, I knew she wouldn't be back. I said to her, would you think about it? Would you think about what I've just said? And she waved her hand at me and left. And I felt badly because I thought that she will never come back. And I wasn't sure that she would think about what I said. I had lost her. About a month or two later, a psychiatrist came to the seminary to talk to the seminarians. And after his talk, I asked him if he would talk to me privately. Being on the faculty of the seminary, I knew where the beer was kept for medicinal purposes, and we could go and have a beer together in the infirmary. So we went up to the infirmary and we sat down, and I said, Doctor, how do you teach someone to love? And I don't know if you people know this, but there's a certain wry smile that psychiatrists reserve for celibates. It's a weak little anemic kind of smile. Like only a priest would have asked that question. And when he gave me that little smile, I said, "Hey, Doc, Doc, don't sit me down now on your lap and give me the little boy treatment, okay? I asked a serious question, and I want a serious answer. How do you teach a person to love?" And this man, this psychiatrist, is superb. He's just magnificent. And he said, "Well, I wouldn't be a good psychiatrist if I answered your question directly, so I've got to ask you a question. Why do you want to know? Why do you want to ask me that question? How do you teach people to love?" And I said, "Well, there was this girl. I had given her mother a retreat, and they brought her down here, and I talked to her, and I told him the whole story that I told you. And I said, she never really could think of anyone but herself." And he said, "You want it like a big boy, right?" And I said, "Right." He said, "Everything you did to that girl was wrong. You really hurt her. Father, you don't teach anybody to love. Becoming a loving person, someone who really goes out to others, has to be a free decision. People have to decide that they're going to be loving. And you can't teach a person to make a free decision. But you can facilitate that. You can help them to come to that decision. But first, you've got to find out why people don't love. Now, I agree with you. This is a pretty loveless world. There are not many people who can love a great deal. But do you know why?" And I said, "No." He said, "Did you ever have a toothache?" "Yes." "Yes, I had a bad toothache." He said, "Whom were you thinking about when you had your toothache?" "Me." "That's right. You and who else?" "Me and the dentist." "Right. You and someone who could relieve you of your pain." Now, anybody who's in pain is preoccupied with himself. He's thinking of himself because he hurts. Remember when you had the toothache? What if someone had said, "Hey, let's play charades," and you would have said, "Go away. I'm hurting." And when you see a young girl like this who's in bad pain, and you say, "Love somebody," what she's really saying, no matter how sarcastic or sardonic she becomes, what she's really saying is, "Go away. I'm hurting." He said, when those parents walked in with that girl the first day, you should have seen her problem. She's really hurting because she hates herself. Her father has trained her to hate herself. Her father has been standing in front of her like a full-length mirror for 18 years, reflecting back to her only an image of ugliness. Her father thinks of her as the scum of the earth. He was willing to embarrass her right in the doorway of the seminary. No respect at all for her personhood. She hates herself so much that she tried to kill herself. And I said, "What do you mean by that, doctor?" He said, "When she drank that bottle of vodka, didn't you recognize that as a suicide attempt?" I said, no, I didn't. "Really?" He said, "I would bet my MD that when the doctor came and injected her and revived her, as consciousness started to come back in, deep down inside of her soul was a groan, "Oh, don't. Don't bring me back. Please don't bring me back. Don't make me come back." And the thing she does not want to come back to is herself. To come back to being me. She wanted to die. That's why she drank the vodka. That was no lark. She hates herself. Why does she pick a bum for a boyfriend? Why does she pick this hustler in a pool hall who's never held a job? Because when you fall in love, you don't want to fall in love with a saint. You couldn't breathe the same air. You want to look out across at. So you pick someone who's on your level. And she picked a bum because she thinks she's a bum. And you know why she doesn't go to church? You know why many young kids don't go to church? Oh, they make up all sorts of reasons. You know why she doesn't go to church? If she ever walked into church, she would hear God thunder at her, "What are you doing here, you slut?" She would hear her father's voice as the voice of God. "What are you doing here? Get out of here. My father's house is a house of prayer." She wouldn't feel at all welcome in the presence of God. So she was a little girl with a gigantic pain. "Do you know, Father," he asked me, "that suicide is the second highest killer in the college age group?" Now that I'm teaching at a university, I know that. There are many attempts, suicide attempts, in a college age group. "Do you know that that little girl had a gigantic pain? And that first Sunday that her parents brought her down to the seminary, you stood up for her. You talked to her father. And you know what she saw? You were going to be her dentist. You were going to relieve her of the pain. You were going to tell her that she really wasn't as bad as her father had been telling her all these years. You, a decent man of the cloth, you were going to stand up and take her part. And oh God, how she wanted that. How she wanted you to tell her that you're all right. And she said, "Could I come back and see you?" And you probably thought that she liked you. But people that are hurting that much really can't have much affection for anyone else. Their own pain is so preoccupying. When you have your toothache and that nerve in your tooth is dying and it's throbbing, you're not in any condition to be available to anyone else. And your agony calls out, "Where's the dentist?" And so she trusted you. You said, "Yes, sure, you can come." And you held out warm, affectionate hands to her. "Sure, you can come down, honey. Sure, anytime you want." And she thought, "Oh, I found the dentist. I found someone who's going to tell me that I'm not really bad." And she came. She came out from behind her wall. And you hit her. You said to her, "Your father was right about you. You are no good." And I said, "Wait a minute, doctor, wait a minute. I never said that." And he asked, "When you tell a person, you know what you need? You need a Copernican revolution. You need to find out that the whole world doesn't really revolve around you." Do you have to add, "I don't like you"? Or isn't it rather clear? Oh, you're right. You're right, Doctor. He said, someone else may come along in a dentist's uniform. Someone else may say, hey, you can come and see me. But will she come again? Will she come out from behind her protective wall, her veneer, again? I don't think so. Once burned, twice cautious. And I really felt terrible about that because I saw that he was right. Her real problem, which is the real problem of most people, I should say all people, is she hated herself. And she's looking for a dentist. And sure, she's self-centered. All self-centered people are in pain because it's pain that magnetizes your attention to yourself. And so I wrote her a letter. I wrote her a love letter. And I often joke that when the final anthology of love letters in the English language is collected, mine should get an honorable mention. And I said, honey, would you please come back? I want to talk to you again. I really do. And fortunately, she came back at the request of this letter. And when she came into the seminary, bad priest that I am, I put my arms around her and I hugged her. And she stiffened in the hug. And she said, what does this mean? And I said, what does it ordinarily mean when you hug a person? And she looked up with very suspicious eyes and she said, you don't like me. And I kept hugging her. And I said, would you try to believe this? I really want to like you. Would you give me another chance? And so she resumed her visits, but she wasn't changed. She was still a little girl in pain, wanting someone just to accept her the way she was and not scold her and not give her sermons. Just love her. Just give her the dignity of a person. Just give her the gift of a little time and attention. And so I never used my portable pulpit. I never asked her if she wanted to go to confession or why wasn't she going to church or when was she going to stop drinking. I retired all my sermons. And she kept coming, visit week after week, visit after visit. And one day she came in and she said, know what I did? I said, what did you do? She said, I went to confession. I said, oh, I'm glad to hear that. She said, yeah, I said, I've been going to Mass now for a couple of months. I said, how about the drinking? She said, oh, I haven't touched much in a long time now. And your boyfriend? Oh, I got a wonderful boyfriend now. It had all turned around because she found in me, after the psychiatrist, someone who would just accept her and love her and not scold her and not criticize her. She found someone who was a dentist who said, hey, you're really worth something. And she became worth something. And every Christmas, this was many years ago, she's happily married now, and she has a lot of children, and they live at a great distance from here. But every Christmas, I get a card from her with her family, and they're all these smiling little faces, and she's smiling, and her husband is smiling. And every Christmas, I look at that picture, and I say, what if the psychiatrist hadn't come to to the seminary. What if the last words that girl remembered hearing from me were, "You need a Copernican revolution"? Where would she be? It's going out and loving people, accepting them wherever they are, caring for them, being patient with them, that God is found. God is found both in the person who loves and in the person who is loved. And the thing that keeps us from loving, and the things that keep others from loving us, is a four-letter word called pain. Psychological pain, doubts, anxieties, fears, these imprison us. All obnoxious qualities in human beings are really cries of pain. The liar, the braggart, the deceiver, the arrogant, all of these obnoxious qualities. There's no obnoxious quality in anyone that you could mention that isn't really a cry of pain, that isn't really a disguise, sarcasm, used to cover the terrible hurt inside, in the heart of a person who really can't love himself. But if you were really to believe that and really incorporate that into your life, that when you see an obnoxious person like that little girl, and you know what she really needs is to be loved. She doesn't need my sermons. She doesn't need my threats. She doesn't need my abuse. She needs me to accept her, to clothe her with self-respect, to believe in her, to build a pedestal for her, because she'll climb up on it. Think about the people in your life, the people who are hurting, your wife, your parents, your children, people who are looking for a dentist, the people who may not be very loving because they hurt too much. And remember the question, did you ever have a toothache?